It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Transgender could be defined out of existence under Trump administration. That's the headline from a New York Times story detailing the planned rulemaking by the Trump administration to narrowly define gender as a biological, unchangeable condition determined by genitalia at birth. The move would roll back equal rights protections for transgender people currently available under federal civil rights law. Are you transgender? Do you talk to people about it? Do they accept you as you are? Or do you find a lot of negative attitudes and misconceptions? What do people have the hardest time understanding? Are you concerned about these moves to put biological definitions on gender, or does it make sense to you? What factors into your perspective? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Brian Powell is a professor of sociology at Indiana University. His research is focused on family, education, gender, and sexuality. Brian, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning, John. Thank you for inviting me.
For those who may not know, define for us what it means to be transgender.
Transgender involves two parts. It involves, first of all, the sex that you were assigned at birth. And it's really weird phrasing to think you were assigned a sex at birth. You know, a baby does not determine, you know, their sex at birth. You know, parents or doctor does. And they do it based, in terms of sex, they do it based on genitalia or some type of physical indication of it. They could look for chromosomes, you know, but chromosome testing. But they're using sexual genitalia typically in terms of their definition of sex. On the other hand, there's gender, and there are many different gender definitions of gender. But as that applies to transgender people, it is, and to the rest of us as well, it is what we identify as. So most people, there's a consistency between the sex they were assigned at birth and the gender they identify as now. For transgender people, there's an inconsistency between the two. They may have been assigned sex male at birth. And by the way, there are also what's known as intersex, or people who do not fall into either category at birth. But there can be people who define themselves as one sex, or defined as one sex at birth, but they define themselves as the other gender, as the other sex, and that's transgender.
So do we know how many people in this country consider themselves transgender?
This is a really tricky figure to come up with. The current estimates, and I suspect that these estimates are underestimating it, because this is an area in which I believe many people would be reluctant to publicly define themselves as transgender. The current estimate is around 1.5 million people in the United States.
The New York Times obtained a memo from the Department of Health and Human Services proposing that government agencies adopt a uniform definition of gender. It would define sex as either male or female, unchangeable, and determined by the genitals the person is born with. Brian, can you unpack how this would affect people who don't identify with the sex they were assigned at birth?
Well, the first thing it does, it basically tells 1.5 million people or more that they don't really exist as they see themselves as existing. It is, you know, as you noted in one article, the negation of the existence of a certain group of people. This is not unlike, by the way, what happened in Iran. In which Iran, it was announced there's no such thing as homosexuality. They do not exist. So it is, in effect, just denying the existence of what people, what they believe they are, what deep down they believe they are. So that's number one implication. The second implication is that it emboldens people who are not comfortable with the idea of gender, any type of gender fluidity, to basically be discriminatory to the people. And to, in fact, you know, I don't want to use the word bully too much, bully them, for example, within schools. The third thing it does, it can deny certain services to transgender people, and it denies certain rights. Does it mean then a person can be denied service in a restaurant because they're transgender? Does it mean that they can be fired from a job because they're transgender? To the extent that sex discrimination prevents those things, but transgender doesn't count in terms of sex discrimination, these things can happen.
Why would the Trump administration want to do this? What's the motivation behind this move?
I can't go into the mind of the Trump administration or any administration, but I suspect there are two key reasons for it. I think the first one is I don't believe it's coincidental that this has been released, this information has been released a few weeks before an election. There are many people who are not comfortable with the changes that are going on within regarding gender. They are not comfortable with the rapid change that's occurring. And I would suspect that I can imagine that this is a way to encourage those people to vote. So that's number one. I think the second one is the Trump administration and many people who have been supportive of the Trump administration simply wants slower, if any, change regarding how we view people who have been marginalized in our society, sexual minorities, racial minorities, women. And I believe that this is, I think their position would be not that we're trying to discriminate, but we believe that this is not the reality. And the reality is you are a boy or you are a girl. You are a man or you are a woman. And just, the idea of having boundaries that are more fluid, I think is something that the Trump administration and many other people may be really uncomfortable with.
So the definition proposed by the Department of Health and Human Services is also expected to be adopted by other departments, education, justice, labor. That certainly is going to have some consequences. You want to speculate on that a little bit?
Well, the consequences, across the board. Our society is very gendered. If you are a man or you are a woman, you are treated differently. You have different rights. You have different services that are provided for you. Just a very simple case, the case that people talk about all the time, what bathroom one uses. And to the extent that gender, to the extent that women and men have different options available for them, to the extent that gender plays any type of role, this decision is going to have an impact.
A narrow definition of gender proposed by the Trump administration would strip transgender people of protection under federal civil rights law. And we're talking about what this would mean with Brian Powell, a professor of sociology at Indiana University. His research is focused on family, education, gender, and sexuality. Brian, when we come back, I want you to talk a little bit about how this might impact the way transgender people see themselves. For our listeners, what do you think of this move? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? If you are transgender, how concerned are you about what would or could happen if this narrow gender definition goes into effect? Give us a call and share your story. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues in a moment. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Our conversation continues with sociologist Brian Powell about a proposed redefinition of gender that would leave transgender people without any protections under federal civil rights law. You can join the discussion and tell us what you think about this move by calling us at 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org or tweet us @WPR Mornings. Brian Powell is with us. He's a professor of sociology at Indiana University. His research is focused on family, education, gender, and sexuality. Brian, how would this change affect the way transgender people see themselves, do you think?
The recognition that one is transgender must be a very, very difficult thing for many people to reach. And for many people, this occurs, you know, in their teenage years, some of them in their early 20s, in periods of times that are really challenging for everybody, for most people. The idea of being told that what you define yourself as, what you see yourself as, what you deep down believe you are, is not, you know, and just to deny that, it's going to have a powerful effect on people's notions of self. There, you know, could this have implications in terms of their mental health? Yes. Could it have implications on their likelihood to some type of behavior that would be harmful to them? Absolutely. Could it result in them becoming closeted and denying who they are, and in turn then having impacts on other people as well? Absolutely.
Do you see differences between what transgender people face and how we treat gay, lesbian, and bisexual people?
I think there's, there are many parallels between the two. And I think if we look at the attitudes that Americans had regarding same-sex couples and regarding gay people, like 15, 20 years ago, we would have found that about 40% of the population would be supportive and 60% would not. It's completely flipped in a really short period of time. So it's over 60% of the people now are supportive of same-sex couples and same-sex marriage. It's closer actually to 70. And it's been a flip. Right now, the research that my team has been collecting indicates that views regarding transgender people is precisely where Americans were about 15, 20 years ago on same-sex couples.
So there are parallels then between the transgender rights movement and the gay rights movement?
Absolutely. I think the difference, there are a couple of differences. I think one of the differences is there had been, regarding gay issues, it had been something that people had been discussing for a long period of time. And it had intensified in the 1990s and the 2000s. When it comes to transgender issues, it's a more recent phenomenon in terms of public discussion. I mean, there have been transgender people for a long, 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 long period of time. But it's only in the past few years that there's been a surge in discussion on it. And I think so one of the differences is when it comes to thinking about same-sex couples, when it comes to thinking about gay people, it was a period of time for people to, as Obama said, evolve. When it comes to transgender people, it's coming in public views, it's coming very quickly. And I think that's one of the reasons why there has been, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why public views haven't changed that much, because it's still such a short period of time.
Is this a case of where policy moved faster than public acceptance?
I think another difference between gay issues regarding gay people and in same-sex couples. In that case, public opinion seemed to basically precede legislation and court decisions. It's hard for me to imagine the Supreme Court would have reached the decision regarding same-sex marriage had public opinion not been in favor of same-sex marriage at that point. For transgender people right now, some of the changes that occurred during the Obama administration were changes that were really powerful changes and improved the lives of many transgender individuals and their families. But some of those changes did occur before public opinion has reached the point that the majority of people really accept the notion of what transgender means.
Let's take a call. Dan is with us this morning in Drummond. Dan, welcome to the morning show.
My question is this. How much would you say the religious factor gets into this? I mean, you got people who call themselves Christians who say, well, the Bible says this and God says this, and I'm just wondering how much effect that has.
Brian, go ahead.
I think religion is a key factor, or certain types of religion is a factor. I think people who take sort of literalist positions regarding religion in particular have been the most resistant to changes, in terms of providing rights to transgender people. This is also the group of people that was most opposed to same-sex marriage, and this also, if we go back 50 years ago, was the group that was most opposed to interracial marriage. So yes, religion plays a role. Ironically, right now, the people who define themselves, who are very religious, or define themselves as very religious, who are opposed to transgender rights, are also invoking science at the same time. And that's a really interesting change, because often you see this, it's religion versus science. In this case, many religious people are trying to invoke religion also as their reason why they are opposed to transgender rights.
I want to circle back to something we touched on a little bit earlier, and that is the differences between sex and gender. In your research, have you found that most people generally understand that there's a difference between sex and gender?
I think most people do not understand it. And quite bluntly, if you read most articles, including the New York Times article, they confound these, you know, they confound the two. You know, sex and gender are pretty much used interchangeably by most people. And we did, we conducted surveys with approximately 4,000 people in the past year on the issue regarding transgenders and the definitions and views regarding transgender individuals. And I can just tell you, people do not distinguish between the two in their minds.
So how does this confusion around sex and gender play into people's understanding of what it means to be a transgender person?
I think most people, I think there's several different categories of people. There's one category of people who they appear to at least understand what transgender individuals define themselves to be. And they privilege identity. What does the person identify as? And that group, and this group probably is around 40% of the population at this point, believes that transgender people should be defined as whatever they define themselves to be and should have corresponding rights. The remaining group do not see that. Instead, they believe that deep down you are what you were born as. And more than anything else, just as the Trump administration guidelines seem to be emphasizing sexual genitalia, it is sexual genitalia that is defining what they think of as men and women.
So what would it take for more people to understand and accept transgender people?
Well, one thing, we can learn something from the changes in public views regarding same-sex couples and homosexuality. And that is exposure to the topic and exposure to people who fall into those categories. We can think of the number of people, the number of family members who tell their other family members that they were gay, or told their friends, who told their coworkers. That has a very, very powerful effect on people's views. Having television shows or media in which public figures or actors, actresses, politicians talk about their own experiences with a transgender relative or being transgender can have a very, very powerful effect. I think the more personalized we can think about people, the more likely we are going to respect them and give them dignity.
So is this going to take, for lack of a better metaphor, an Ellen moment on national television to start changing the way people see transgender people?
Well, let's put it this way. There wasn't just an Ellen moment. There was an Ellen moment. It was on Roseanne. It was on Will and Grace. It was on many shows. But I think we're going to have multiple of these moments.
Yeah, I was oversimplifying for time, as is my habit.
Of course.
Thank you. This has been a fascinating discussion, and we will continue to follow this issue. Brian Powell, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, John.
Brian Powell is a professor of sociology at Indiana University. His research is focused on family, education, gender, and sexuality. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. One in 20 children between the ages of 12 and 17 has been the victim of sextortion, according to a new study. Sextortion is an act that involves threatening to share embarrassing, vulnerable, or sexual images with others unless certain demands are met. That's according to a new study of American adolescents. We talk with a cyberbullying expert about the issue of sextortion, which has been identified by the U.S. Justice Department as the fastest-growing cyber threat to children, as well as what might be done to try and prevent it. Parents, what's your reaction here? Are you surprised to learn this is happening? Teens, if you're listening at this hour, and we know you are, has this happened to you? If you're willing to share your story, we're willing to hear it. What do you think can be done to try to prevent this from happening? Or is misbehavior inevitable as long as teens and technology are involved? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Justin Patchen is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. He was also one of the authors of the study that we'll be talking about. Justin, welcome to The Morning Show.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
First of all, give us a definition of sextortion.
Well, sextortion is basically when somebody threatens to disclose to others or post online explicit images that were shared in confidence. So someone might share a topless or otherwise sexual or explicit image with a boyfriend or romantic interest, and the person who received the images then threatens the original person if they don't send them more images or give them money. So the idea is to try to extort other images or money or something of value from the person who shared the image with them.
How is sextortion different from so-called revenge porn?
That's a great question. So the difference, the primary difference is with revenge porn, the images are already posted without really contacting or threatening the person. So the person shares the image to get revenge, and so those images are already posted somewhere or shared with others. With sextortion, the desire of the aggressor is to get something of value. So, of course, the sextortion could turn into revenge porn if the threats are essentially carried out.
What are the legal issues surrounding sextortion? I mean, I'm assuming that this would be treated kind of like blackmail, but I'm probably wrong. What does the law say?
Well, that's also a good question, because there aren't really clear laws that deal with this specific type of behavior. And so what would need to happen is exactly what you're saying, having to kind of shoehorn these behaviors, these new behaviors, into old laws, whether it's extortion laws or blackmail laws, or, you know, threats generally. So we really don't have any clear laws that deal with this particular behavior. And up until relatively recently, the behavior was pretty much legal. If you know, we had been in some sexual exchange and photographs had been taken and I owned the copyright, I could do essentially whatever I wanted with those images. Or if you gave them to me, then I could do whatever I wanted with them. And it's only been in the last few years where states have recognized that this is something we need to deal with on a legislative front, but they've been slow to respond.
Would this be considered a form of sexual abuse?
Definitely. And so, again, any sort of threat made as a result of these images being shared could fall under sexual abuse, or we call it image-based abuse, but clearly there's that sexual component there.
So according to your study, 1 in 20 teens say they've experienced sextortion. How significant a finding is this?
Well, it's significant to the extent that prior to this, we really didn't know what that number was. And so this is the first study of 12 to 17-year-olds. So we looked at middle and high school age students in the United States. And there had been a couple of studies of adults who had experienced these behaviors, but nothing of teens. And we had heard some kind of anecdotal stories of young people who had experienced this, but we really didn't know how widespread it was. And so we surveyed them and asked about their experiences and found that about 5% had been the victim of sextortion, and about 3% of the students we surveyed admitted to threatening others with explicit images that were shared. So I think it's a good kind of baseline of the extent to which this is happening among youth.
We're talking about sextortion with Justin Patchen, professor of criminal justice at UW-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Parents, what's your reaction here? Are you surprised to learn that this is happening? What questions do you have for our guest about sextortion? What do you think can be done to try to prevent this from happening? Or is it inevitable as long as teens and technology coexist? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Speaking of technology, Justin, to what extent has this issue been fueled by the ubiquitous nature of smartphones?
Well, smartphones and their capabilities certainly make this easier, right? Because you've got a camera in the palm of your hands. You've got the ability to share anything with anybody pretty much anywhere. And when you have some people, particularly adolescents, being more prone to impulsivity and doing things that might seem like a good idea in the moment, they can act on impulses in that moment and, for example, share an explicit image with somebody, not considering the potential long-term ramifications. So while this could have happened 30, 40 years ago, somebody could have taken a picture, could share that picture with somebody else, and threats could be made. Of course, it would be days, if not weeks, between the time of taking a picture and sharing it, and there's only maybe one picture. I mean, copies could be made. So it could have happened years ago, but it's a lot easier now.
So who's most likely to be a victim of sextortion?
Well, we only looked at a few different characteristics. We surprisingly found that boys were more likely to be the victim of sextortion than girls. Most of the kind of public incidents that we're aware of involve girls who are targeted. And there's one other study that surveyed college students about sextortion and kind of found the same thing. But we also found that those youth who identify as non-heterosexual are more likely to be the victim of sextortion. Perhaps they put themselves in a position to be more vulnerable because of their identity and their status, and maybe they're not out with friends, for example, and so it's easier to threaten them. But we really didn't find any, for example, race difference, really not even any significant difference by age. We expected it to go up as kids got older, and generally it did, but not a kind of nice, neat, linear trend like we expected. So there's a lot more that we need to investigate to figure out who's experiencing this and why.
You also found in your research that many teens are both victims and offenders of sextortion. What explains that?
That's right. And so primarily those who admitted to us that they had threatened others, so had participated in sextortion, were disproportionately likely to have been the victim themselves. And so it could be a lot of things. Now, our study wasn't longitudinal, meaning we didn't collect these data over time, so we don't necessarily know which came first, but we speculate that the victimization came before the offending. So if you threaten me, then I'll threaten you, or if I'm the victim of sextortion, then I see this as maybe, you know, normative behavior or at least tolerable behavior, and so I'll threaten others. But we're not at all surprised by that, because in most of the kind of online and offline, frankly, for that matter, behaviors that we explore among youth, there is a very close connection between a victimization and offending. So we see that with bullying and cyberbullying and other behaviors as well.
What was the thing that was the most surprising about your research results? Were there any real aha moments here?
Well, apart from the fact that boys seem to be involved more than girls on the victimization front, I wouldn't say it was really shocking, but it's telling that the vast majority of the time when these things happen, the person who's making the threats is someone known to the target. So most often it's a boyfriend or a girlfriend, which makes sense, right? So you share an image with a significant other in confidence, hope you can trust them, and it turns out in some cases you can't, and they make a certain threat to share those images. It also happens the person making the threats is some other online friend or other friend in real life. So the somewhat surprising thing was it's very rare for the person making the threats to be a complete stranger. So it's not like somebody, for example, hacked into a computer and stole images and then made threats, or somehow took over the webcam on a target's computer and got the images surreptitiously. So in the vast majority of cases, the images were originally shared with someone the person knew, trusted, was in a relationship with, and eventually that relationship turned and the threats were made.
We're talking about sextortion with Justin Patchen, professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Parents, what's your reaction here? Surprised to learn that this is happening? What do you think can be done to try to prevent this from happening? Or is this type of misbehavior inevitable as long as teens and technology are both involved? Give us your take at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at ideas@wpr.org is the email address, and you can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm John Munson. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. It's been identified by the U.S. Justice Department as the fastest growing cyber threat to children. It's called sextortion, and according to a new study, 1 in 20 teenagers have been victims. We're talking with one of the authors of this study, and with you if you care to join us at 800-642-1234. Justin Patchen is a professor of criminal justice at the UW-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Justin, without a doubt, nobody wants to feel exploited, especially in this manner, but teens can be particularly vulnerable. What kind of harm can sextortion cause?
Well, the sort of short answer to that is we don't know. I mean, we definitely, in our study, identified it as a problem and talked to, and surveyed youth a little bit about kind of their experiences, but didn't really dig into how it affected them emotionally or relationship-wise or at school. And so I think that's a fabulous question for the next iteration of this survey. I think we can speculate based on our research on cyberbullying and sexting and other behaviors that it's not positive, and it really creates this sense of helplessness, particularly among youth who are put in a pretty tight, tough situation, because, you know, if a if a minor shares an explicit image of him or herself with someone else, technically speaking, they've broken the law. They've distributed child pornography. And so if somebody else is threatening them, threatening to share those images, or threatening to basically tell on them, to call the police, that's a pretty significant threat. So you have a situation where a young person makes a mistake, does something impulsive, and essentially could put them in a very difficult situation. And so we need to address that as well.
Let's take a call. June is with us in Milwaukee. June, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to talk about my son had an incident. He's college age and was on Skype one night being stupid, and then was told that he had to pay this person in the Philippines $500 on Western Union, or everything would be spread on Facebook to, they could hack his account and send those to everyone he knows on Facebook.
And was this somebody he knew?
No.
All right. June, thanks for the call. Justin Patchen?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what those are the examples we hear. Although, again, as you sort of pointed out, John, it's a little strange that it was somebody that they didn't know. And the research among adults seems to bear that out. So it's more likely that kind of experience, somebody they don't know, is going to happen among an adult than a child. But the scenario is the same. I mean, you get put in a situation where you make a mistake, you do something that you probably shouldn't have, and now somebody's got those images over you, and so you definitely have to think twice before sharing those images in the first place.
June, thanks for that call. Let's go to Matt in Milwaukee next. Matt, welcome to the morning show.
Hi. I'm not necessarily a question, more of a comment. I believe as a parent, it's my job to educate my children about who they should share private photos with, or if somebody does share a private photo with them, how they should treat that. That's okay. Pretty much it.
All right, Matt, thanks so much. Justin, does the focus need to be on parents teaching teens to not share graphic images of themselves? And if so, how do you get teens to take that seriously?
Well, certainly parents need to have these conversations with their kids, and they're not easy conversations, and it's hard to know at what point, at what age, to be discussing these things. But I think the best way to approach these issues is to share with your kids the example of these bad incidents. And so I think young people are more persuaded by potential incidents that could actually happen. So if you show them, for example, you could read about Amanda Todd and her experience a few years ago and how she made a mistake and and basically shared an image with essentially a stranger online, and that stranger then stalked her for many years, and talk with your children about these incidents and how to avoid them, and the fact that you may trust your partner at this point, but you never know who they may share this image with or if their device might get hacked. We are having conversations with educators as well on whether or not these kinds of issues need to be brought up in sexual education classes. But I think parents certainly are the first line of defense and need to have open conversations with their kids, but also establish that open line of communication. So if they do make that mistake, they're not afraid to come to a parent because, again, they put themselves in a situation where they have nowhere to turn and desperation sets in. And as a parent, I'm sure we'd rather have our kids come to us with these kinds of concerns than to run from us.
Well, conversely, is this about making sure teens understand issues of consent and abuse? Should we just accept that teens sext and make sure they're safe?
Well, some teens sext, and in our research, it's about 25% of high school students have done this, have shared images, explicit images with others. It's hard to know what exactly will kind of stop a student from doing that. What we know doesn't work is kind of deterrence or threats of kind of criminal prosecution. What we speculate works based on some preliminary research is kind of that relationship with a trusted adult, a parent, an educator, and having that conversation. And the parent, for example, expressing to their children that, look, these kinds of, you know, sharing these images is inappropriate. Here's why. Here's the kind of trouble it could get you into. Please don't do it. And if they're getting that same message from all of the respected adults in their lives, then it'll be less likely for them to do it. But also, sort of, if somebody does share an image with them, not to disclose it to others and not to threaten that person. And in fact, maybe the best thing to do is to delete it right away and tell that person, look, please don't send me these images because I don't want to put you in a difficult situation. And what if my phone gets hacked or there's just too much at stake?
So the U.S. Justice Department has labeled sextortion as the most important and fastest growing cyber threat to children. So what's the role that the Justice Department ought to have in combating this issue, do you think?
Well, certainly, I think they're involved in dealing with the more extreme cases, particularly where strangers hack into devices or manipulate, groom users, children, and, you know, kind of these people we label as predators. And I'm not, you know, of course, this is the first survey of teens to assess the nature of this behavior, but, you know, the federal government is involved in examining, investigating the most extreme cases, and so they must be seeing more cases to be able to make that claim, more extreme cases. So, you know, again, from a, it'd be useful if the federal government got behind kind of a prevention approach where we educated young people about this, and certainly they would have a role in investigating the most extreme cases.
What other research do you expect to be doing? What research needs to be done on this topic, and how do you plan to follow up this study?
Well, we're hoping to collect more data again next year, and the first thing is basically just replicating what we did to see if the numbers add up, to basically see if there's consistency across the measures we used and things like that. But we really didn't dive in that much in the mindset of the person who was making the threats. So we learned a lot about the target, but didn't really delve into the aggressor and why they did it and what they were trying to accomplish and how many other targets they had targeted, basically. And so while there's a lot that we don't know about victimization, there's hardly anything we know about the mindset of the person who would do this to someone else.
So plenty more room for research on this topic. Justin Patchen, a professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Justin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, John.
I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.